Mr. Michael Sargent, could you first tell me where and when you were born?
I was born in the UK, in Fulmer and Bucks, in 1942.
What was the date?
30th of August. Yes. Yeah.
And who were your parents?
My parents were Graham Sargent, and my mother was Peggy Sargent. My father was a stock jobber, as his grandfather, as his father was before him.
Which firm was he with?
He was with a firm called George D. Atkin, which had been started, I think, in the 1890s by two Atkin brothers, George D. Atkin and his brother Sanya. The other two partners in the firm were Stanley Sargent, who was my grandfather, and John Herbert Sargent, who was his brother. Mm. So that was the start of the firm. Mm.
Which markets did they deal in?
They dealt mainly in those days in the electric light companies. And also the bus companies, and as well as those, overseas transport companies like Anglo-Argentine Trams, Manaus Trams, Port of Pará, those sort of funny things, all of which, of course, disappeared. And after the war, the electric light companies were nationalised, and actually so were a lot of the bus companies, but that didn't happen until sort of fairly long after the war. And because of that, they obviously had to look around for something else to deal in. And they took up dealing in the brewery market in 1948 or 1947, I think, probably, which really became their major market as a firm. And by that stage, they had got, I suppose, about 8 or 9 partners, one of which was my father, who joined the firm, I think, in the middle 30s, 1933, 1934, something like that. But had, obviously then, obviously the war caused a lot of them to have a gap for 5 years or whatever it was. But anyway, and so in 1948, their main market was the brewery market, and also the sort of companies that were associated with electric light, like GC, AEI, English Electric, those sort of companies, and the remnants of Anglo-Argentine Trams and whatever.
Did you ever know your sergeant grandfather?
Yes, I did. Oh, yes, very much so. He lived to a fairly ripe old age. Into his 80s.
Did he continue jobbing for
no,
a long time?
No, he'd stopped. Mm. He'd retired before the war, as had John Herbert Sargent, the brother.
Had he ever told you anything about stock jobbing or the stock exchange when you were young?
No, he hadn't, and actually didn't talk about it much, I seem to remember, after I'd come into the firm. I used to talk a lot about it to my father, who by the time I joined the firm, which was in 1961, he'd retired. He retired in 1955, I think, at a nice early age, but he decided he'd suffered from a rather, in what in those days was a nasty duodenal ulcer. You couldn't do much. There wasn't much cure in those days apart from surgery, and it wasn't very conducive when you've had that sort of thing done to stand all day on the stock exchange floor. I think.
So did you learn much from your father about the firm before your time? I mean, it's before you became involved.
Yeah, a little bit. I used to know, we used to, in those days, partners, and especially in small firms, I think used to know pretty well everything about it. Everything. So they became sort of pretty household names, really. Not so today, I don't think so much, but well, we have a partnership, but no, your colleagues in business don't frequently mix, I find, with your sort of social activities. Get fairly separate. But he used to, yes, we used to talk about the business. It was very much part of one's sort of upbringing as to what was going on and how life was. I never really as a small boy, I never really understood what it was, actually how. I knew that the penny halfpennies were very, very important, and so I always used to, because that was the turn that was made between the buying and the selling price, and sometimes it was more than a penny halfpenny. But you were very happy with the 3 farthings even in those days, and I used to expect him to come back with his pockets full of pennies and halfpennies.
Did he intend that you would go into the family firm?
No, I don't think he did. And my mother certainly wasn't frightfully keen to have another stock jobber in the family, because, you know, it was a fairly well rewarded profession even in those days. But it had its risks as well, and I think the ups and downs of, and which is true today, of course, but you know, in partnership days, obviously the partners were liable for the firm's losses, and I think they'd had their ups and downs, and so they had good years and bad years, and I think she had rather hoped that I'd go into a more stable environment. But my father did nothing to either persuade me or dissuade me from joining the firm or going to the stock exchange, and indeed, I had no intention or no active intention anyway of joining the stock exchange, even after I'd left school, because I left at the age of 18 and had no desire to go up to university. My father said in that case, he was very much against one going straight into doing something, because he was keen that one should travel and see a bit of the world, because he used to say to me that once you start a job, it's very difficult ever to do that, and particularly if you get married and have a family. I mean, your window of opportunity then becomes very far out, and by that stage you're probably too old and too exhausted to bother to do it. So he was very instrumental in seeing that I had a sort of couple of years off, so to speak, if I wasn't going up to university.
Where had he sent you to school?
I went to Marlborough. And so I did a stint in stint around the world, and I suppose and by after when I, by the time I came back, one was quite ready to settle down to when it got the sort of wanderlust out of your system, and I was quite happy to settle down, and it just sort of seemed a sort of natural somehow, just to join what was his former firm. But the senior partner then was a man called Ronald Quirk, who became a deputy chairman of the stock exchange later on, and incidentally was instrumental in joining the firm with in 1970 with Ackroyd and Spillers. But I'm the senior partner, and he was also happened to be my father's cousin, so it was all a bit incestuous, if you like. But that's, you know, so it was a sort of family firm. But he made it very clear, both to me and my father, that whilst he was happy to have me in, I would only stay in if I made the grade, so to speak.
So when was it that you joined them?
I joined in November 1961, and at the vast salary of £5 a week, I think. And in those days, in Atkin, didn't matter who you were, you started at the bottom and you worked your way through the messenger department and up through through the general office, through this what we called in those days a statistical department, which was nothing more than sort of collating statistics about the companies the firm dealt in, and etc. etc. So you know, for months I was literally just running around the city delivering stock to all the various brokers, and then, as I say, going through the general office, and I didn't set foot on the stock exchange floor until 1963, I think. When one became what we called a blue button, which I'm sure you've come across. But they were, for whatever reasons, whether they were short of dealers or whatever, I missed out the stage of being what we called an authorised clerk. I became a member of the Stock Exchange in 1964.
How would you describe the firm when you first joined, say around 1960? Was it a typical jobbing firm, or was it a big jobbing firm?
It was fairly typical, in as much that most, in 1960 there were probably, I suspect, about 100 jobbing firms. Quite a lot of them probably only had two partners, and quite a lot of them were what was called sort of book and pencil firms. I'm sure anybody else talked about that, but really, just they were firms that would just sort of act as a filter from business from one side of the house or one side of the floor to the other. They really didn't put up much capital or take much risk. They were almost akin to sort of $2 brokers in New York. But it was fairly typical, as much that most firms I can look it up for you, but I suppose they had about 8 or 9 partners in those days. And they dealt in a particular sector of the market. They didn't have a very big coverage. As I say, they actually did breweries, and they had certain fixed interest. Actually, they did some press and debs in the companies that they dealt in too. We hadn't yet embarked. I think it's fair to say that it was the Durlacher firm that first saw the advantage of getting bigger and getting bigger, broader spread across markets, and therefore getting more capital. So they, I suspect, by then had begun to merge with other jobbing firms. They were rather unique then, I think. Although other people, it fairly quickly caught on. So they were pretty typical medium-sized partnership, which specialised in certain sectors of the market.
What kind of premises did you occupy?
Well, I only ever saw one office. When I joined, they had just moved from Draper's Gardens, which was being knocked down to make way for the NatWest, or National Provincial, I suppose it was then, tower, which is still there, which was probably one of the first skyscrapers in the city, I suspect. So they'd just moved to Bishopsgate, and that all that's gone now and made way for whatever's there now. And jobbers traditionally had no need of smart premises at all. It was purely functional. You tried to find an office that was near to the stock exchange, because obviously people went to the office first and then down to the floor and back again, so you didn't want it too far, but also as cheaply as possible. So it was a purely functional office of, I think, three floors, with the in the basement we had basement on the first floor was the settlement side. The basement you had what laughingly went for IT in those days, because I'm just beginning to get very, very slightly computerized. With all the cards and whatever. And then upstairs you had two or three rooms which would where the partners would sit, with the telephones, where they dealt after hours, depending on whether it was breweries, electric light, or press and debs. And then in another room we'd have the blue button clerks who would run around sorting things out.
What was the atmosphere like in that room when you started? Was it fairly, were you all quite young?
In the blue button?
Yes.
Oh yes, we were all sort of either teenagers, late teenagers, or early 20s. And all literally lowest of the low, beck and call of everybody, hoping that we would get our yellow badge and progress there on to becoming a partner. But some people made it, some people didn't.
And would you leave that stage and in 64 became a member?
Yeah.
What did that entail for you in terms of your own work and involvement in the firm?
Well, it meant that I could deal on behalf of the firm, which I think was what they wanted, and actually take risk positions and make markets. And I went straight onto what was the main book in those days, then become the main book, was the brewery book. And it's a book I stayed on through the various mergers that we went through forever. I mean, I have never, I suspect, there aren't many people who've stayed on the same book for all their jobbing life, but I've never jobbed in anything else apart from breweries.
Can you remember what it was first like when you went onto the floor of the house as a dealer? I mean, not necessarily the first day, but the first part of...
Totally. I mean, it was the old floor in those days. Much more like the sort of New York Stock Exchange, the old part of the New York Stock Exchange. They're very, very similar still, really. Totally confusing as to which door you would ever find your way in or out of. And of course, in those days, one had waiters who were, the most modern then sort of form of communication was, if you wanted to find somebody on the floor, was to go to a particular stand there. We all the firms had a stand number, various stand numbers, where if you wanted to deliver any messages or any letters or anything, you went up and left it with the waiter at that stand. But if you actually wanted to find somebody, you'd tell the waiter who you wanted, and he'd yell out, that, the name, and put a light up a number, so that if the guy hadn't heard, he might look up and see that his number was alight, which knew that, which then he knew that there was either a message for him at the stand, or somebody wanted to see him, or whatever. Mm. And as I'm sure you've been told, that around the floor were brokers' boxes, and telephone exchanges. The Extel, that was about the extent of the high tech that one had.
You say that you were put onto the main book, the brewery book. What did that actually mean? Presumably you weren't running the book yourself.
No, I was very much the boy. We had four other partners on the book at the time, and I was but we used to split it into three, I seem to remember, and so one would sort of, although everyone would know what was going on across all the brewery stocks, you actually had sort of your prime interest was in either the A to F or the G to P or the R to Z, and I think I was on the A to F, as it happens. But then as you got a bit more experience or became more proficient, so you would be given a longer lead, so to speak, and allowed to make have your view and put forward, and occasionally when you are left on your own. Even take some quite big dealing decisions. Dealing quite big in those days, they wouldn't be considered very big now.
Well, could you tell me what each of you were doing who were running the book? Presumably there was a partner who kept an overall eye on what was going on and made the basic decisions about taking on positions and so on.
Yes, I mean, there was myself and another dealer who weren't partners, and then there were three people who were sort of full time on the book who were partners, and actually Ronnie Quirk, who was on the book but by this time was on the Stock Exchange Council, so wasn't there all the time, so he sort of he stood back from it a bit, but was always used to come and look and see what we were doing, so the, obviously the partner, it was down to the partners in the end. It was their money we were playing with. So if they disagreed with any of the positions or what we were doing, what they said went.
If a broker came up to deal, who did he actually go to?
They would. 99 times out of 100 would go to a partner, because in those days although when I joined the firm there were a lot of dealing clerks, i.e. dealing for the firm, brokers dealing clerks, it was still very much the custom that the partners of the brokers would come down onto the floor and do the business themselves, although that was beginning to wane, because I suppose just with the sort of increase in business and everything, the way life went, and they used to, as I say, employ the authorised clerks to deal for them. But in the early 60s, still the broking partners would come down to do the business, and they liked to talk to jobbing partners. They were on the same level, and they probably for old friends as well. That gradually, by the time we got to 1970, that gradually died, and I suppose one was a bit more senior in the firm and been around a bit, so they were broking partners, if they did come down, might talk to the boys on the book who weren't partners and be happy to deal with them. I do remember dealing with one of the, my first deal with one of the, one of the one of the characters of the floor, who was probably considered to be one of the most important people down there at the time, who was the dealing partner with Cazenove, who's called Charles Purnell, who dealt with me in 25,000 distillers, which was, for those days, a reasonable sized bargain. But he felt that even though I was authorized to deal for the firm and a member of the exchange, that he called across, I think it was Ronnie Quirk, and got him to confirm the bargain, because he wasn't talking to a partner, and probably someone he didn't know very well. So I mean, that was that was not uncommon, I suspect.
In the normal course of events, did you refer back to the partner?
Yes, if yes, but only really if I mean, there wasn't much point in putting you there to deal if you weren't allowed to do some of the smaller business. I think one used to always refer and consult, and so did they amongst themselves. If a broker wanted to come and deal in a bigger size, and then one would consult as amongst oneselves as to what should make the broker. And certainly, if you were, if you were just a boy on the book and just a, and not a partner in the firm, you would never dream of doing that without consulting. So, yeah, you had a bit of a lead, but as I said earlier, you were risking their money, so you consulted with them. But they would anyway amongst themselves. I mean, it's part of how you run the book. I mean, you need to have someone have the final say, but you want to build in everybody's opinion.
Did the firm have a particular approach to jobbing?
I don't think so. I don't think. Not in a way that, say, someone like Blackwell had an approach where they, as you may have picked up, they were chartists. They dealt very much on charts as to whether the stocks were going up or down, what the chart said. So they took positions. I think we were a much more usual sort of jobbing. I mean, we just tried to make money out of sort of the order flow and trying to read which way markets were going to be. We were neither very cautious or otherwise. I think we weren't risk averse, but at the same time we didn't take abnormally large risk positions either. I think we were pretty middle of the road, and therefore one hoped that you didn't make huge amounts of money, or you didn't run the risk of losing a lot of money either.
Were there many other jobbers in the brewery market?
By the time I started dealing, I think there were only two. But there had been, when Atkin took the brewery market up, there were more. There were certainly four. But by the, when I started dealing, our competition was Durlacker, and on their brewery pitch they had some pretty formidable people in terms of Sir Nigel Mordaunt and Jack Durlacker. Jack Gittins, who was there. And they considered it to be one of their premier pitches, and I think did very well out of it. We were much smaller; we had much less capital than they did. And I would say that in those days, in the early sixties, the split between the market share between the two of us was probably interesting to hear what they would say. But I would say it was 75-25, very much in their favour.
Mm. Was it a good market to be jobbing in?
It was a very good market, because it was particularly as it was a two-jobber market, because it's a much easier market to control if you've got them in, providing that the two jobbers in it have sufficient capital and are going to provide sufficient liquidity for the business to run. And I think we did, and we had a very happy relationship with WED. They were very competitive, but one got on with one's competition and got to know them very well.
Did you ever find yourself challenging directly?
Oh yes, I mean it was in those days, or right up until Big Bang. The convention was that if you heard that there was what we would call a choice price or a backwardation, one would go onto the pitch and open one's business to them, and they would have the opportunity. They could either deal with you or not, as they felt fit. I mean, there was no, you weren't obliged, there was no obligation. And sometimes we did and sometimes we didn't. Yes, well, I used to do quite good business. Mm.
Did you ever get bargains that were too big for you to handle and you'd pass them on to WED? Well, as a firm.